Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
All right, well, we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about dating. And I'm afraid we're going to turn to what is probably one of the most overused examples of millennial life these days, the HBO series Girls. But just hear me out, because we're about to play a scene between Friends with Benefits' Hannah and Adam, played by Lena Dunham and Adam Driver, and it serves as a kind of cultural nod to why so many people seem to think that traditional dating is dead.
I respect your right to see and do whoever you want. And I don't even want a boyfriend, so.
What do you want?
I just want someone who wants to hang out all the time and thinks I'm the best person in the world and wants to have sex with only me. And it makes me feel very stupid to tell you this because it makes me sound like a girl who wants to, like, go to brunch. And I really don't want to go to brunch, and I don't want you to, like, sit on the couch while I shop or, like, even meet my friends.
Okay, well, to me, honestly, this is kind of a sad scene. It's so analytical and transactional. But in our current economy, what else should we expect? Millennials are told, quite frankly, all workers are told that they have to be flexible in their careers, that they should expect nothing more than short-term gigs in the current job market. So is it any surprise that they bring the same approach to the dating market? Well, that's one of the arguments Maura Weigel makes in her new book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. Weigel says dating and the economy have always been powerfully and inextricably linked, and she'll be talking about it at Harvard Bookstore tonight, but she's in our studio now. Maura Weigel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And listeners, we do want to hear from you as well. Do you think the current dating market or the way that people date is linked to the economy? Or how do the two mirror each other? Do you think dating is dead or just evolving with the times? And what questions do you have about the history of dating? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, Maura, I'd actually like to start way back in time.
Okay.
We'll get to girls again eventually.
It always gets back to girls eventually.
But at what point in time, or when in history, did this thing that we currently recognize as dating even get started?
Well, dating was invented, I like to say, in 1896.
Because there's an actual date. There's a fixed date.
I'm a historian. Well, I'm joking a bit when I say that way. But the word date is first used on the print record, as far as we know, in the sense that we now use it to mean two people meeting up, two people who are romantically interested meeting up, in an article in 1896. And it was thought to be quite disreputable at that time. I could tell you about how it was reinvented as a reputable thing to do a little later. But
okay, disreputable, why?
Well, the invention of dating, as I call it, has everything to do with women beginning to work outside the home. And the first women, you're in the 1890s in America, it's this period of profound economic crisis, and you also high immigration numbers, a lot of young people and coming to cities to find work, and a lot of young women who maybe could have afforded not to work earlier until marriage looking for work outside the home. So the first young people who have the freedom to meet one another in public in this way, to go on dates, are mostly poorer people, working class people. And indeed, when the cops first see women letting men buy them things in public in exchange for something, yeah, they think it's prostitution. So a lot of the first women who make dates in the 1890s, really through the 19-teens, end up getting arrested, harried by the vice squad, sent to the reformatory, that kind of thing.
Wow. Okay. That's kind of disturbing to think that this common, like, mating or ritual that we have now is viewed as something that the vice squad should be called out on. But the thing that you said that was key there is that the economic reality of the time was that we had a lot of women in the workplace,
mm-hmm,
pre the turn of the century.
Yeah, and I think we sometimes forget that because there's such a powerful cultural narrative in the 60s about, like, women going to work and leaving behind the feminine mystique. But among working class women, huge numbers of women are already working by 1900 outside the home.
Yeah. Well, but even before that, so even before the dawn of dating as we recognize it, just to remind folks, I mean, this is where, honestly, images of of English dramatizations of Jane Austen. books are popping into my head, but that seemed to be courtship was, right? I mean, it was even way more transactional than it is now, right? Because, I mean, individual choice wasn't even really part of the picture, was it?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, so the practice that most middle-class Americans used to court one another before dating was they called calling, and that is the Jane Austen-ish scenario where, you know, a young man comes when you're holding your office hours or your calling hours to your house and asks your mother and aunt for permission to see you. Working class people, of course, didn't necessarily have living rooms or aunts sitting around to watch them. So in that case, maybe it would be a factory dance or a church social or something like that. But the key thing is that courtship took place in these private or semi-private places like a church dance, and that it was supervised by adults. And what the invention of dating is, I would say, is when young people start going out on their own. It's sort of a more free market, you could say, approach to courtship. The grown-ups aren't supervising it anymore, and it's happening in public places outside the home.
Mm-hmm. But the end point was supposed to be marriage.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in the Jane Austen scenario, the sort of place where it's happening, the people who are providing the space of courtship have a stake in you getting married. And as you said, it's an economic arrangement in a way. Your parents care if you marry the guy who's calling on you with his hat and, you know, his gloves. Once it starts happening in bars and restaurants, the people who provide the forum for dating, they have no stake in whether or not you marry. You know, the bartender will be happy if you keep coming back. And indeed, as it is with dating apps now, it's better for those businesses if nobody ever stops dating is to keep, you know, really, there's no incentive to get anyone off the dating app. Tinder ideally would have you playing Tinder forever. So I think that's a big change. So all that to say, I think for most people, most unmarried Americans still say they want to get married. Yeah. I think many people still see it as a means to the end of marriage. But the reality is that once it comes out of the home and out of the family, it's much more ambiguous what it's for. Mm.
Well, what happens then after the turn of the century? Because, you know, in the 1890s, you were talking about urbanization and an influx of women into the mm-hmm. into the labor pool, into mm-hmm. the labor force. In the early 19-teens and, of course, the 20s, we have the Gilded Age.
Right.
Then quickly followed by the Great Depression. But what was dating like in the teens and 20s?
So when I joke that there are two inventions of dating, I always say the second one was in 1914, Ladies' Home Journal, which is this extremely respectable publication, very widely read, refers to a young woman in college, a sorority girl, going on a date. And it's in scare quotes, but they don't define date. They clearly assume their readers know what it is, and it's a nice girl who's doing it. So I think I highlight that because in the teens, you start to have hugely more middle-class young women going to college, mixing with men in this way. And when we think of the Gilded Age, like the great scenes from F. Scott Fitzgerald novels or some things we've probably maybe forgotten, but Hugh Carver's novel, The Plastic Age, some of the big 1920s books about these wild young people. That was when dating sort of became actually not middle class, but sort of more upper middle or upper class. And then it's a little later that it becomes sort of the middle class institution that we remember from the 50s. But
yeah. Well, help me with my historical timeline here, because in the book you wrote about people right now, in this day and age, tend to fret a lot about hookup culture. Mm-hmm. But you write that, was it in the 20s there were these things called petting parties? Do I have
yes.
that right?
Yes, and indeed there was a headline. It was either in the Atlantic or the New York Times, I can't remember, but from 1921 that said, "Mothers complain that women vamp their sons at petting parties." So I think this in the 20s, there's this profound anxiety about young people. And it's so interesting because the parallels to the hookup panic today are so direct because it's very focused on colleges and college campuses. We forget now the phrase sexual revolution was coined about the 1920s. In the 60s, writers first start talking about a second sexual revolution. The 20s is this age of petting, and people talked about joyriding and cars and coking, which was going out for cokes. And if you read novels from the 20s about college students or watch movies that were actually made then before the new rating system that came in the 30s, it's pretty risque. I mean, you see young women. I just the other night watched a film called The Wild Party from 1927, where we see the main character make out with multiple young men at a party at her school on screen in very scantily clad. So anyway, these anxieties are older than we sometimes imagine, I think.
Well, listeners, we're speaking with Maura Weigel. Her new book is Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. And in the book, she talks about how if you look at, let me see if I can describe it this way. If you sort of traced America's economic history, you could find a lot of overlap between that and America's dating history as well, that the two are pretty closely intertwined. And we're wondering what you think about that. I mean, do you think current economic realities, current market realities are influencing attitudes that people bring to dating? Or are there other things that are more powerful influencers today? We'll talk about technology in a moment. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet also at Radio Boston. Before we get back on sort of the historical journey that we're taking, which is totally fascinating to me, Maura, I'm just curious. Part of me is also a little disheartened, not necessarily by your thesis so much, but maybe just by the cold truth that matters of dollars and cents have always played a role, whether consciously or subconsciously, in what, you know, in ideal, we should idealistically see as emotional interactions or relationships between people.
Yeah, I think, you know, in America, in the West, and in Western culture, I think we tend to really idealize love and sex in a different way. But we like to imagine that they somehow stand outside the current of history, that, you know, sex is a matter of biology and love is a matter of some kind of spiritual affinity or ideal. And I think, I hope it's not depressing. I think that's not true. I think that our emotions and our desires are very much shaped by economic forces and by history. I don't think that makes me a determinist. I do believe there's still space for genuine spark and connection. I mean, I'm not saying that it's only, you know, only about cash or money in some disenchanted way, but I do think the structures of our feelings and desire change.
Well, so in that case, through that lens, has dating always been kind of a luxury of the rich or more affluent Americans, because it involves time,
right?
In different periods of American history, as we've been talking about so far. I mean, you talked a lot about college students in the 20s.
Yeah.
Has it been more focused on those groups?
Well, I think popular representations of it certainly have. And I'm forgetting, some sociologists did a study on hookup culture where they were exploring how the extent to which the participants in it are mostly white, mostly middle to upper middle class, mostly, you know, fit a certain background. And of course, if you have to work your way through school, or you're not living there, you can't do those things. So I think that there's still a disproportionate emphasis on certain kinds of relatively privileged people. In the mid-century and a lot of the 20th century, dating is an engine of social mixing and social mobility. Starting around the 70s or 80s or so, that starts to become less true, it seems. So I think dating is a very widespread phenomenon in American history for many classes of Americans. Mm. Perhaps it is becoming more of a luxury good. Marriage certainly is in the United States.
So can I ask you just about what you just said? Because I remember reading a New York Times article from late last year that talked about, as you said, in the 70s and 80s, and especially now, that there's far less socioeconomic mixing going on with dating than virtually ever before in American history. That, you know, if you're an investment banker, you're likely to date other or even date and marry other investment bankers, just to draw a broad brush there.
Right.
And is that one way in which, you know, we're talking about how market forces might shape dating, but that dating then could be reinforcing certain economic realities in America now?
Definitely. And that's, I mean, frankly, as a feminist, it's this really sort of tricky thing to grapple with, because this trend that you're describing towards what I think biologists would call assortative mating, people mating with people who are like them, that has everything to do with women, lucky women, privileged women, getting certain expanded opportunities. So whereas in earlier generations, perhaps a doctor would marry a nurse or, you know, a businessman would marry his secretary. Now a doctor can marry a doctor. A woman can be a doctor and a secretary can be the businessman or the lawyer, whatever it is. And so we see, again, starting in the 70s and 80s, a lot more marriage. Dating is really hard to measure. It's really hard to know exactly who people are dating. But in terms of marriage, there's definitely this tendency towards people of similar backgrounds and incomes marrying each other, which of course reproduces and intensifies this growing economic inequality that's happening in the 70s and 80s anyway.
Right. Well, let's go back to our historical journey here, because mm-hmm. I'm finding it absolutely fascinating. Post-war America, mm-hmm. In the late 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. there you write about how there's this introduction of the concept of going steady,
yeah.
which hadn't really been part of the dating scene in America before. What was it about America's post-war boom that led to steadiness.
Well, you know, a lot of different historians have talked about this. This is also an era when the marriage rate drops dramatically. It's not the case. I think we sometimes think people have been getting married older and older throughout time. It's not true. It gets younger right after World War II. And I think some of it is this sense that our boys are home. People want to get, you know, start life, start families. And that probably trickles down in a way and influences younger kids. But I, from my perspective of someone, again, who's interested in the economy, I think it also has everything to do with how much disposable income kids suddenly have. There's this whole new teen culture, this emphasis on teens buying LPs and going out to movies or going out for a burger and a root beer float. And I think there's this culture for sort of full participation and for everyone to participate. It can't be that 20s scenario where it's one girl and six boys trying to dance with her. People pair off and go out. So I think there are a lot of factors. I think nuclear anxiety also has to do with it, which yeah. might sound crazy, but you know, everyone wants someone to do it with if the bomb's going to drop. You know, no one wants to be alone if the bomb's about to fall. So I think that probably plays into it, too. There are a lot of factors.
Yeah. Well, in the book, Labor of Love, moving forward here, you have a chapter that begins with a quotation from the movie High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've actually got that clip here. Of course, it's John Cusack playing Rob Gordon. Here it is.
What really matters is what you like, not what you are like. Books, records, films, these things matter. Call me shallow.
But why'd you point that out in the book?
It's actually really related to this question of class and sorting in some ways. So I became, to tell a little story, I first started thinking about this particular issue when I was in grad school at Yale in New Haven, and I would be riding the Metro North train, and I overheard a young woman telling her friend about this really sexy encounter she'd had the night before, and she described it in very sort of lurid, too high volume detail, but sounded like it had been fun. And then the next morning, he opened up his laptop and he started playing Limp Bizkit, which is this band. And she's just like, there was no way I was giving him as my number. I left. And I thought that was so funny. And I think a lot about how we tend to assume, I think, that certain likes and dislikes, certain elements of taste, like Cusack is saying in that movie, that they're good predictors of romantic compatibility. So I became fascinated by, why would that be? Why would we think that, you know, if I love David Foster Wallace and you love David Foster Wallace, we should be together? So that was a quote that really captures that for me. It's especially important in an age of online dating.
Well, I was going to say, aren't we in a world now that makes those tendencies even worse? Because
Definitely.
We can parse people's interests down to the finest detail and make all sorts of decisions before we even sit down across the coffee table from them.
Definitely. And it becomes literally part of the search requirements. I have a friend who joked about trying to meet people on OkCupid, and he's a literary person, and putting in different writers. And he said, you know, David Foster Wallace doesn't cull it down nearly enough. It was still hundreds of people. And then he tried someone else and it was too obscure. And he said, Alice Munro. I put in Alice Munro. I got six women. I went on dates with three of them, and it's 5 years later and he's still with number three of the Alice Munro fans.
Well, at least it worked out then.
Yeah.
There was some predictive element factor to that. So we started with girls and dating in 2016. There's another piece of tape that I want to introduce here to talk about what sort of the transactional reality or feel that it seems as if dating has today. So here is a clip from Aziz Ansari's Live at Madison Square Garden show last year.
You send the first text, you're all confidence. Forget about it. It's done. 20 minutes later, no response. Okay, well, I'm sure she's just busy with a couple of things, and any minute now, 3 hours later, I put too many exclamation points in my text! What was I thinking? I should have said, hey, with 2 Y's, not 3 Y's, I'm so stupid! And this is when people start going crazy. And then you go on the internet, you're reading stuff like, eating ice cream and watching Dexter, # I really need a man. What? I just asked you out. You know I follow you. You know I'm reading this. What kind of evil is inside of you?
So, Aziz, I'm sorry, having some fun there. But I mean, this is, I don't know, like millions of posts, hundreds if not thousands of books have been written about technology and dating. How do you see that factoring into this whole history of dating that you've written?
Well, I tend to think of technology in a very broad sense. Like, a technology is a way that we interact with the world, and it arranges us in relation to each other. So a car, also a technology people were really worried about dating couples going in together alone in the 30s. Our current dating technologies certainly have made profound changes in how people meet one another. I mean, that hilarious clip, the ability to obsess over every little minutiae, all the minutiae of communication forever, has certainly been intensified by our current technology. The OkCupid statisticians have this incredible post, which I think Christian Rutter talks about in his book, Dataclism, but they studied how many times the average person edits their first message to someone they message on OkCupid. And I forget what the exact figure is, but it's something like it usually takes 32 edits to get to a message of hey. So I think that this propensity for obsessiveness that we feel is maybe intensified by the tech.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I guess what the worry that people have is that, maybe to link back to where we started,
right,
that a lot of people, young people now, because of the economy, and they're told to have short-term expectations for their jobs, for example, or they came of age in which nothing was guaranteed, that,
right,
that people are concerned that there's a lot of focus on the transactional elements of forming a relationship rather than the ultimate benefit of having had the growth experience of being in the relationship to begin with.
I think that's true. I think, once again, I mean, where we started or early on, we were talking about this issue of prostitution, and I think that dating has had what I call a prostitution complex throughout its history. And if we look at our language for it, on the market, off the market, friend with benefits, sealing the deal, I mean, it's just permeated with economic language through and through. So I don't know if I think it's totally unique to our era. I think the way in which these, many people now feel that they're using sort of an Uber for dating when they use Tinder, or a Seamless for dating when they find someone through an app, perhaps that intensifies that sort of transactional aspect. Perhaps it just makes it more visible. I'm not convinced it's worse than, getting pregnant in high school in the 50s with your study and then having to marry that person and be with them forever. So I always want to push back a bit on the pessimism about these apps. But,
well, I think that's excellent pushback and an excellent reminder that the kids are going to be all right.
That you'll be all right. That's the takeaway.
Well, Maura Weigel is author of the new book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. She'll be talking about it tonight at Harvard Bookstore. We've got information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Maura Weigel, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.